Welcome back to part two of my interview with artist, musician, composer, and all-around likable guy, Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo. What do you read, Mark?
I was just reading. The last thing that really turned me on that I read was Everything Is Illuminated, the Jonathan Safran Foer book.
Right.
Did you read it?
No, I have not read it.
Well, I read it and then found out they were making a movie, and I really got aggressive about going to meet what's his name, Lee. Shriver.
Liv?
Liev Shriver, yeah. He was here, and so I was out here for something else, so I made a point of getting together with him and meeting, but he had already decided in his head he wanted to hire this guy who was a friend of his, a violinist from a band called the Wild Colonials.
Sure, yeah.
So he ended up, I think that's who ended up scoring the film. And but
people don't know that side of you. They may know in a peripheral way, because they hear your music, that you've done very well for yourself, scoring and actually the Saturday morning. The reason I know is because I have kids. Well, actually, I hear the stuff all the time, and it's terrific. And also Pee-wee's Playhouse, and I was a huge Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Yeah, fan. Yeah, the Pee-wee's thing is what started me down this thing where I've done a lot of kids' TV shows and feature films now at this point, and games and things, but kind of went a couple different directions, you know. I've done, you know, feature films, like kind of bigger things.
What are you most proud of?
I like independent films. I like working with Wes Anderson. Mm-hmm. I think we've had a successful collaboration over the years. I've done all of his movies.
Is it true, Ernie? Is Ernie his father? Was his father Ernie Anderson?
No.
But Ernie Anderson migrated to California.
Yeah, Ernie Anderson went out to California and became very successful as a voiceover. He was the highest paid voiceover guy for a while before he died, and then his son went on to make some good movies.
Okay, there was the other Anderson.
Yeah.
And he was Goularty. He was Goularty back
He was
in,
Goularty, yeah. He saved my life when I was a kid, because there was nothing to when you're in seventh grade, you're not old enough to drive a car, and there's nowhere you can go, and you're in Cuyahoga Falls, and yeah, we went down in the basement and turned on the black and white TV, and Goularty broke the rules.
Right.
You know, he walked into these old movies and that you'd already seen three or four times, like 1 Million BC or
Attack of the Killer Crabs.
Yeah, stuff like that. Yeah. And then he'd, like, halfway through the movie, he'd climb into the movie with a blue screen, a really crude blue screen, and he'd, like, make, like, he'd say beatnik jokes, and then he'd, like, you know, get in the way of somebody and trip them when they're being chased. He knew the films well enough that he could, like, you know, kind of have a minimal kind of interaction with them.
Right.
And it didn't take very much to amuse us. And then he was blowing up plastic models, which was, you know, I was like, yeah, I want to do that. So it's like, I remember when I was a kid, I'd make these models, and before the paint was even dry, I'd already have, like, firecrackers, and they'd be rolling down the driveway.
You got to blow them up. I forgot, you know, you just reminded me of blowing up models. God, thank you for that memory, because my brother and I did the same thing. That's great. Let's get back. I'm sorry, because I like hearing your other passions as well. What else do you like? When you choose to read something, is it just a spur of the moment thing, or do you find yourself attracted to a lot of different types of fiction, or is it more modern, current literary favorites? Or
I don't know. I go through phases,
yeah.
I go through phases with reading, and it's usually things that are somebody turns me on to, and I'm lazy.
You probably don't have that much time with all the scoring you're doing. I met Robert, who's running your business, and
he's running the commercial.
And he says you guys do, like, I don't know, 60 to 100 commercials a year, plus all your other scoring. I mean, how do you have time to do anything? How do you find time to tour?
I turned down two movies.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. So it's costing me money to be here. What?
Close the apes.
I'm okay. Don't worry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good night. That was my mom. I bring her with me everywhere.
That was the maid. Thanks. Thanks, Mom. Is it still exciting for you, Mark, on stage? Do you still get that surge of excitement when you're in front of a crowd of people, like in the early days?
Well, playing on stage is a great thing, and it's different than it was in 1977. You know, it's different than it was in 1985, even. But it's great. You know, it's what we're doing is we're doing the music that was our big statement as artists. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, I think we're definitely, you know, part of, you know, I think a lot of artists, you would say that they make a big statement when they're younger and then do permutations on a theme
right
afterwards. And I think Devo's kind of like that. I think I look back at the things, I look at the things Jerry's doing, I look at the things I do, the things the Bobs do, and I see the connection back to Devo.
Right.
And, you know, that's, so it's great to go back and go back to the source of it where we first started. And the downside of it is that, you know, we're old and we know too much now. So it's hard to get excited about airports, hotels, backstages, interviews. No offense.
None taken.
I mean, you know
I'm
what I mean?
I'm from Akron. Come on, I get some props, right?
It's like the 22 and a half hours that you're not on stage.
Right.
It's now we know what they are. We did it 3,000 times. You know,
right.
We did it in every country. And now it's kind of like, okay, so, you know, it's dull up until you get to showtime, and then showtime's great.
You guys are amazing on stage still. I mean, the musicianship, obviously you know the material inside and out, but the connection with the audience and seeing like two generations of Devo fans now is kind of cool.
That's the thing that was kind of a pleasant surprise in the last 3 or 4 years that we've been playing, is noticing that there is there are people that were too young to have known about us first time around, you know, and they have a couple different kinds of stories, and usually it has something to do with their parents' records collection, you know,
right.
That their parents were listening to Devo and then they picked up on it. And, you know, it's either like I was 4 years old and I've waited my life to see this concert, or it was just they're even younger than that and they were just like, I was just checking out my dad's vinyl and I started hearing these Devo records, you know, so.
Right. That's cool. Yeah, it was great.
Kind of fun.
There was a couple last night that had like two young kids and I thought that's great, and they were like, and they know their music, your music from that the other side of you, you know, the mm-hmm. Rugrats stuff. So it probably wasn't a leap of faith for them to hear the textures and the sounds that you build anyway from that world. As you said,
yeah.
you influence your own self, or the band influences some of your writing.
Yeah, yeah.
The three songs you wish you would have written, or one song you wish you would have written.
Satisfaction.
Well, you rewrote it. That's not
I
fair.
I did. We did the best job we could on rewriting that thing.
You did. I mean, you know, there's few artists that can take a song that is that well known and mm-hmm. rewrite it and give it its own personality. Maybe Hendrix with All Along the Watchtower taking a Dylan song. You guys with Satisfaction. They're very,
and that song is, to me, is like, in some way is like the quintessential Devo tune in a way too, because it's the one that when people would say, what the hell are these guys doing? They could listen to that song and then extrapolate, you know, from there, because they go, wait a minute, I know this song, but I don't know this version of it.
Right.
And it was so radically different that you know, it helped people go, oh, okay, they're about positive mutations. They understood what we meant then when we said that. So I wish Devo would have written that song instead of just rewritten it, but...
Well, Whip It is a cultural, I mean, it's just, it's probably viewed the same way for a different generation.
Maybe. I don't think so.
No, but I mean, if you look at...
I think it's a lighter weight song than Satisfaction. Satisfaction was great on every level. And maybe I'm just saying it because it was important to me, because for me it was important because I remember playing it, the 45, in my living room, and some woman from my mom's church came over and goes, "Mary, how can you let him listen to that song? It's dirty." And then they left, and my mom's like, "Whoa!" And then they left the room, and I was like, I had to listen to it like 100 times more because I kept, what's the dirty part? I kept trying to figure it out what she meant. Then it made me like the song even more because I'm like, wow, I missed out on the dirty part. What is it?
Oh, that's great.
But you know, it's Whip It, on the other hand, was really misinterpreted because. It became a song that was, like we'd go in, we'd be waiting to go in to see a DJ, you know, we'd be waiting outside, right. and we'd hear what them on the air, you know, and it'd be like before a concert, and the DJ would go, "All right, we have the band that's got the new hit, Whip It. Yeah, I whipped it just this morning." And we'd be like, "Oh, you asshole.
That was slap your mammy, man.
We already," yeah, exactly. "We already hate you and we don't even know you yet."
Look, you guys really ushered in the age of the video. You guys made MTV what it was. You know, that video was heavy rotation and probably built up their core audience. So
yeah, too bad we weren't businessmen, because we would have started MTV and we could have helped a lot of artists out, even to this day, that have suffered because of what MTV was, which was, I think, ultimately a negative force in pop culture.
They devolve quickly.
Yeah, I mean, they sold out right near the get-go. It's like it could have gone somewhere else, and it could have been a new great medium that that like supported artists that were working in both sound and vision, and instead they became just a home network shopping for record companies. And
yeah. But you guys were into it anyway. I mean, your Devo with your art films from the get-go, you guys were really doing it before anyone was doing it. So
yeah,
you guys were
like
the pioneers.
We were about 6 years ahead of MTV.
Yeah. Is there one single track in all of your work that represents you and your persona or your...
I don't know. One single track. I think people change, you know, somewhat through time. But I think if there's one that I'm probably... If you had to erase everything else off of my resume and I could only keep one thing...
Right.
It would be the Rugrats theme. No, I'm kidding. No, it would be... although I like the Rugrats theme.
That's a great hook.
It would be Jocko Homo. I mean, Rugrats theme only because I like it that all these little kids know that tune.
Yeah.
But it would be Jocko Homo for me because I think that's the song that is kind of like, could be like the theme song for Devo in a way.
Yeah. Why Chichi Rodriguez and a golf ball on the cover of the first album?
Well, you know, simultaneously... in parallel parts of Summit County, well, not Summit, not even Summit
County.
I know
County, where you're going with this.
Jerry was collecting images, and I collected images, and I found a pack of golf tees that had that. Let's see, it must have been 72, 73. During that time, Chichi Rodriguez sponsored some crap golf supplies, and they made these little hanging cards. It had a picture of his head in front of a golf ball.
Right.
And then the bottom part of the card would say, golf tees, practice golf balls, whatever. Marker, you know, like the marker you stick in the ground.
Right.
I forget what they call those. Marker. It's just marker.
The marker, yeah.
Yeah. And you could buy these different... And I remember... And I was already collecting novelties that came in hanging packs and toys that came in hanging packs just as a collection. And I added one of those to it, and at the same time, Jerry was into those too. And then early on, I wrote this book called My Struggle by Boogie Boy, and it was an image right. in my book that was Man Is What Man Thinks. And it was a pic, it was the, I just lifted the image of Chi-Chi in front of the golf ball. And Jerry liked it too. And so when we did the single Be Stiff, we thought, let's use that image for the cover. And we did. And then when it came time to do our first album in the U.S., we wanted to do the exact same artwork. And then it was all, they started to print them up. And then some lawyer at Warner Brothers, who was a golfer, said, what the hell are you guys thinking? This is a copyrighted image, and you can't just... We go, we're artists. We're allowed to appropriate things, aren't we? And they go, no. And so we had to go find Chi-Chi Rodriguez and pay him a lot of money. And in the meantime, they changed the artwork. They made me change the art, made us change the artwork. And I had found this image in the worldwide news. It was a composite photo of guess what five presidents' faces were used to make up this guy. And they had this ugly face for this guy that had like JFK's hair and somebody, whichever one had the bags under his eyes, and
right.
somebody else's mouth and somebody else's jowls. And we cut a chunk out of the center of that artwork and stuck it over top of Chi-Chi's face, and then they airbrushed it in. So by the time we ended up finding Chi-Chi Rodriguez on a golf course and giving him like some like stupid like $2,000 or something
right.
to use it, he said part of the stipulation is he wanted to have 100 albums to give out to his friends. So we sent him the albums, but by that time, Warner Brothers had already changed and fucked up his face, so it was this mutated version of him where he looked really bad. If you look at the original photo of Chi-Chi on the Be Stiff single from
right,
England,
right.
he's actually this very handsome Pan-American-looking
right,
guy.
Right,
and if
right.
you look at the picture on the first album, it's like this fucked up mutant. And so I just remember... And I mean, Chi-Chi was totally into it, because before we sent him the album, he sent me all these like both black and white and color, you know, 8x10s of himself, and said, "Here, if you need these for other album covers," as if we were gonna like every album would be Chi-Chi Rodriguez on the cover, which I thought was great. but we didn't do. But we sent him then. So then he got the 100 albums from Warner's, and he probably threw them away once
right.
he saw that. He goes, "Wait,
right.
what'd you do to me?" You know. So we never talked to him again, but I always wanted to have a conversation with him about what happened when he opened up those boxes and the records didn't look right.
Oh, that's like my Velvet Elvis that was painted in Mexico, and he looks like a cross between Elvis and Ricardo Montalban.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Class.
Better than Elvis.
Right.
Better than Ricardo. It's like, or maybe.
Oh, that's great. That's a good story. Visually, who influenced you as an artist on the visual front?
Then or now or when? When then it was like Jerry and I were both very keen on the Dadaists, the Russian suprematists, the Bauhaus movement, the Italian futurists. We liked all that stuff that was happening in the early part of the 1900s
right.
in Europe. In the early third of it, we were really fascinated with like Dadaism and appreciated surrealism, but you know, just loved all those kind of agitprop kind of art forms. And as far as people that were living at the time, the people that were active at the time that we were really keen on were people like Andy Warhol, specifically because we wanted to be like him in the sense that we saw him as like somebody who was about ideas and concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And he would, the solution for those ideas or the materialization of those ideas could be manifest in either a photograph. He was a photographer, he was a painter, he was a screen printer, he was a filmmaker, he threw great parties, he produced the Velvet Underground, you know, fashion designer, I think I
right.
said. But, you know, it's like, he got to do all these things, and he wasn't limited by well, I play guitar, so I'm going to just play one kind of guitar mm-hmm. and do one kind of thing.
He was the first multitasker.
He was kind of like the true modern Renaissance man in a way.
Right.
And that turned us on because we loved technology.
Right.
We loved what was going on. I mean, you know, we thought laser... One of the things that never materialized that we always wanted to do is from the very beginning, I remember talking with Jerry how we had this concept that we would make live shows where we wouldn't even be on stage. What would it be about? I remember we had a song called Wiggle Worm, and I imagined this big, giant, holographic, animated worm that would be going across this mm-hmm. ceiling of a stadium to the sound of the bass, and then other sounds that would be all represented by different images, and we would make these shows that were just surreal, basically.
Right.
And we were just waiting for the technology. We were going to have this... I had this concept for an 8-point sound system where you had a joystick that would go to, you know, inside a cube or a globe. You could put sound anywhere you wanted in the room, so this worm would be going boom, 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 across the ceiling of the auditorium. Then it would go boom, 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 come down the wall, be moving, and then the drums would be doing something else, and they'd be
right.
following a path. And it was, you know, not probably, you know, looking, when I try to think about what it reminds me of, it's not totally disassociated with something like Fantasia in a way, but we wanted to do
right.
it in three dimensions. And mm-hmm. it was because I'd been at the Akron Art Institute in 69 and saw an installation of laser sculptures.
At the top of the list that you can't get pissed. No, you can't get pissed. It's rule number one. Living right isn't fun. Living right isn't fun, cause it's a God-given fact that you can't go back. No, you can't go back. It's a God-given law that you're gonna lose your mind. Yes, you're gonna lose your mind. Time tested and true.
How would you like to be remembered, Mark?
kindly. I don't know.
How about the band? How would you like the band to be remembered?
I would like our memory to be something that people that were artists that were looking for inspiration or looking for someone that they could point to when they're doing art that's an uphill battle.
Right.
That they could look at Devo and find inspiration in that.
Great. Mark, thanks for being on the Culture Catch, and continued success to Devo and all of your art endeavors.
Well, thanks. Thank you, sir.
You've been listening to The Culture Catch with Dusty Wright. I'd like to thank today's sponsor, Final Draft, and to my engineer Dave Lee and Richard Burns, my partner. We'll see you next time. Remember, converge is the word.